Well, the topic in this workshop, this breakout session, is respect for authority and independence of mind. Respect for authority and independence of mind. And one of the first things that occurred to me when I was thinking about this topic is Narnia. I thought that if I want to talk about authority and how to teach respect for authority, one of the places I should go is where I learned respect for authority, and that was Narnia. And if I talk about independence of mind, I want to talk about one of the people who taught me independence of mind, C.S. Lewis, and it shows up in countless ways, not just in the Narnia books, but elsewhere in his writings as well. So what I'd like to do is weave this topic, respect for authority and independence of mind, in and out of Narnia, and talk about this in Narnian terms. And I say this as someone who's learned far more in Narnia than I can ever even begin to explain. And so all I'm going to be doing here in the compass of a small talk is give a small taste of some of the important lessons that I learned there. And this issue of authority and submission and submission, respect, hard work, defiance, when to draw the line, when to bow, all of these are great lessons that are constantly present in the Narnia Chronicles. One of the central lessons that I learned in Narnia, which began when I was five, I think my folks told me that they read the first Narnia story to me when I was five, and numerous times thereafter, I have no idea how many times they were read to me and how many times I read the Narnia stories growing up. And then when we had our own kids, we did the same thing to them. We began reading the stories over and over to them. And, of course, that involved me reading them myself. And then I read them again just a few years ago when I was writing the Narnia chapters for the Omnibus series, which is out on the Veritas table. And these are books that repay revisits. You know, when you go back and visit them again, there's always something new, something more, something richer, something deeper. And on this issue of authority, there is a great deal of wisdom. C.S. Lewis had a great deal to say on this subject, on using authority in the wrong way, on using it the right way, on submitting to authority in the right way. Submission to authority the right way is the instrument that God uses to bestow authority. And this obviously is related to independence of mind. Someone who has true authority, someone who speaks as Jesus did with authority and not as the scribes, is someone who has independence of mind. Someone who can, the rabbis and the scribes who were narrow gauge trains, basically. They would just run on the tracks that were laid out for them. And then along came this rabbi who was a rabbi just like them, but he was a rabbi nothing like them. And he would speak. And what was the difference? Well, the difference is he spoke with authority. He would say things that were constantly surprising. And this is one of the things that Semper Constans Numquam Praedici is a little Latin thing that we have as a motto for Credenda Agenda magazine. Semper Constans Numquam Praedici. Always consistent, never predictable. Right? Always consistent, never predictable. Well, that's what Jesus is like. He's constantly surprising you, but when you study what he's saying, it's always consistent with what went before, and you should have seen it coming. You know, it was predictable, but you didn't see it coming because he taught with authority and not like the scribes. There's a certain kind of boring predictability that comes from just saying your Sunday school lessons in a sing-songy voice. Da-da-da-da, we believe this and this and this and this and this, and then and sometimes someone else can come along and say the same thing, and it's astonishing because they have authority. And of course, if you have that kind of authority is bestowed on you. If you have that kind of authority, you have independence of mind. But the only way to get that kind of authority is to submit to authority in the right way. One of the things that we're going to see later in this talk is that authority flows to those who take responsibility. Authority flows to those who take responsibility. And there's no way to take responsibility without submission. So, if anybody wants to become great in the kingdom, what must he do? Jesus said in one of his surprising little twists. He must become the servant of all. What kind of sense does that make? Right? The way up is down. The way in is out. That's how Jesus would talk all the time. He'd say, if you want to become a great rabbi, you have to become like this little child. This is what you must do. So he's constantly giving us these twists and turns, but it's consistent what he's doing. C.S. Lewis, among all the authors of the 20th century, captures that surprising twist and turn nature of the Lord's teaching as few other writers do. One in the previous century, and earlier part of the 20th century, who did something similar was G.K. Chesterton. Submission to God's authority, submission to authority the right way, is the instrument that God uses to bestow authority. When someone takes responsibility and they submit to authority in the right way, God bestows authority on them, authority flows to them, and they're in a position where they can exercise authority with true independence of mind and not be a tyrant or a petty dictator and that sort of thing. So, the one who wants to be great must become the servant of all. The one who wants to become great must become the servant of all. Jesus does not tell us to rip out the chief seats in the synagogue. He tells us how to get into them. He doesn't tell us to rip down the high table at the banquet. He tells us how to get seated at the high table at the banquet. Right? Isn't that surprising? Well, Jesus says, now if you want to sit at that place of honor, this is what you got to do. You have to take the lowest place. If you push yourself forward and take the highest place, you're going to be demoted. But if you demote yourself and you take voluntarily the lowest place, God will promote you. And then that little death and resurrection of humbling yourself when you took the lowest place means that you've mortified that thing which would be dangerous at the high table. Right? If you just went up to the high table full of yourself, you'd be dangerous up there. If you're seated in the chief seats in the synagogue and your pride is not mortified, you're dangerous there. But if you take the lowest place, then what's going to happen? God deals with the thing that's dangerous when it has authority, and he kills it. He mortifies it by you humbling yourself. An example I've referred to in the plenary talk earlier today, I referred to Francis Schaeffer. Francis Schaeffer was a Presbyterian minister, Bible Presbyterian, and he decided he was going to move up into the Swiss Alps and witness to burned out hippies. What kind of career move was that? Do you think anybody really bought the glossy prospectus that he had printed up? I'm going to go up into the Alps and minister to hippies walking through Europe with backpacks, and I'm going to tell them about the gospel. That's not a career move at all. Right? That's not a career move at all. But even though it wasn't a career move, was it a seed dying and going in the ground? Yes, it was that. All right? And so Francis Schaeffer moves to another continent, goes up in the mountains, has a lodge, witnesses to hippies, and then within a few years, every American evangelical knows his name. That was not a career move. Right? That was not a career move. God was doing something else, far more profound. This is the way God works. This is the death and resurrection pattern. This is the way God works. Death and resurrection. Death and resurrection. He loves to raise the dead. And before we can be safely alive and running the show, we have to be safely dead. Okay, we need to have our flesh mortified, our pride mortified, and then God raises us up again and then entrusts us with authority. So, submission to God's execution, submission to God's authority that way, is the precondition to having authority bestowed on you in a way that is not going to be dangerous. So, let's take this pattern and go back to Narnia with it. True authority is sacrificial and giving. True authority is sacrificial and giving and is embodied perfectly by Aslan himself. Aslan sets the pattern for all authority in these books, and it is consistently and always the pattern of self-sacrifice and giving. This is the basis for all true authority. Jesus Christ humbled himself, took the form of a servant. Therefore, God has exalted him. Right? Jesus emptied himself, took the form of a servant, therefore God exalted him. Aslan does the same thing. He submits himself, he sacrifices himself for Edmund, he dies, he is killed, he is murdered, and then he comes back from the dead. And he has true authority in coming back. And even though it takes many kinds of different forms in these books, it's always modeled on this Christian authority, which is, of course, something that Lewis writes as a Christian, as modeled by Aslan. Not surprisingly, Aslan's faithful servants, like Aslan himself, are sacrificial and giving, just as he is. And in the exercise of their authority, they are very humble. Right? It is possible to be authoritative and humble. That's possible to do. For example, think about Aslan's test of whether Caspian had the right kind of kingly character. Are you fit to be a king? Welcome, prince, said Aslan. Do you feel yourself sufficient to take up the kingship of Narnia? I don't think I do, sir, said Caspian. I'm only a kid. Good, said Aslan. If you had felt yourself sufficient, it would have been a proof that you were not. If you said, I could see myself as a king. Right. Well, I could see myself as the headmaster. Yeah, of course. I could do that in my sleep. danger to whoever the board, the guy interviewing for the board, or someone just says, piece of cake, I could just walk into that. You know, I was born to be the superintendent. I was born administering. Yes, we're afraid so. Okay, the Apostle Paul says, who, speaking of his authority as a minister of the gospel, he says, who is sufficient for these things? And it's a rhetorical question. The answer is no one is sufficient for these things. Everybody who knows even a fraction of the task before us knows that every person involved in it is in this completely and totally over their head. Right? Everybody. Don't come to these conferences thinking that there's a bunch of expert speakers up in front who aren't in over their heads and we're all in over our heads. No. We're all in over our heads. Everybody's in over their heads. Some of us have learned to like it, right? But we're all in over heads. We don't know. How does God bless the way he does? Well, I alluded to this earlier. We can plant and water and we can do everything we know that we're supposed to do. But God's the one who gives the increase. And if God doesn't give the increase, it's just not going to happen. And if God is giving the increase, you could be doing any number of things wrong and not according to the rule book or the playbook, and God's still somehow blessing. And if you know what you're doing, you know that you don't know what you're doing. If you know what you're doing, you know that you don't know what you're doing, and you're going to trust God regardless. H.L. Mencken, who's not a believer, but one of my favorite writers, he didn't love God, but he wrote like an angel. What a stylist of the English language. H.L. Mencken said that self-respect is that deep assured feeling that no one, as of yet, is suspicious. Well, you need to be suspicious of yourself all the time. Are you up for being a king? I don't think so. Good. If you were full of that, you'd be full of yourself, and we don't want you. Those who would possess authority in the name of Aslan must not be full of themselves. Those who would possess authority in the name of Aslan must not be full of themselves. And listen to this. When Kor is just learning that he is to be the king of Archenland, much to his dismay, he doesn't like the idea at all. And shouldn't a king be able to do whatever he wants? He said, I don't want to be the king. And if I'm the king, don't I get to do whatever I want? The answer is no. 'Tis no question what thou wantest, in The Horse and His Boy, page 222. And then a page later, the king's under the law. This is King Loon speaking to Kor. The king's under the law, for it's the law makes him a king. Hast no more power to start away from thy crown than any sentry from his post. Why are you where you are? Because that's your station. That's your post. That's your assigned place. You might not feel up to it, but that doesn't make it something you can just drop and walk away from. Right? Who's sufficient for these things? Well, I'm not. Well, if you walk away, nobody's here, and nobody's probably going to do a worse job than you. So stay at your post. Okay, you can't just say I don't want to be king, or I don't want to be a sentry, or I don't want to be in this position. King Lun explains very clearly to his son what it means to be a king. Now, this is servant leadership that is being described here. And servant leadership applies to servant kings, servant ministers, servant elders, servant superintendents, servant headmasters, servant board members, servant third grade teachers. This is servant leadership. King Lun explains it very clearly. For this is what it means to be a king, to be first in every desperate attack and last in every desperate retreat. And when there's hunger in the land, as must be now and then in bad years, to wear finer clothes and laugh louder over a scantier meal than any man in your land. That's what it means. Right? You might be shaking inside, and it's not hypocrisy to be brave, right, on behalf of others. You're not lying. You're not cheating. What you're doing is giving yourself away. Right? You don't say, you know, some crisis comes up in the school, that you get bad news, and people come into the office to see what you as the headmaster are going to do about it. If you put lighter fluid in your hair and set it on fire and run around in a circle, we're all going to die, and the school's going to close, and you're going to lose your house and your mortgage. Now, you might feel that way inside, but shut up, right? It's not hypocrisy. Say, you know, I've got a station here. I've got to do my duty. It doesn't matter how I feel. My feelings are not the issue. What matters is my duty in this. How does authority flow? I said this earlier. Authority flows to those who take responsibility. Those who take responsibility find themselves in a position of natural leadership. Authority flows naturally to those who take responsibility. Authority puts on its sneakers and runs away from those who try to evade responsibility. Okay, now this is a particularly hard lesson for men, because men, the male ego is brittle. When it's being an ego, it's brittle. When it's doing what it ought to be doing, it is confident and a blessing from God. And everything depends on whether you're watching out for yourself. When you're watching out for yourself, your ego is brittle. When you're watching out for others, you have a resilience and the stamina that other people really need you to have. You can see this. I said earlier that in one of the workshops or somewhere today, I said that athletic competition will reveal someone's spiritual state. Here's another example of that. Let's say there's a boy playing outfield, and he drops a fly ball and loses the game. Okay, it's an important game. Shouldn't have dropped it, but he did drop it. Loses the game. If a bee distracted him, if the fans were yelling, if the grass was wet, or the sun was in his eyes, what you are having, what you're dealing with, is a loser boy becoming a loser man. Even if he winds up winning games, if he's defending himself, trying to evade responsibility, and you're just up in the stands watching this, and he's saying, well, it's not my fault because, it's not my fault because. If you're dealing with an excuse maker is someone who is trying to get authority, trying to get responsibility away from him. He won't take responsibility for failures. And when he banishes the responsibility, and this is the optical illusion, when he's banishing the responsibility, he's banishing the authority. People aren't going to want to follow that kind of person. You've also seen this sort of thing, where the right fielder drops the fly ball and puts the team back, and the left fielder might start yelling at the right fielder. He can start, what do you mean doing it? And make him defensive, and so he starts making excuses and that sort of thing. Or the left fielder can do something like step into it. He was 100 feet away from the ball. He had nothing to do with it, but he can sort of step in and take responsibility, corporate responsibility, for the drop ball. Come on, guys, we can do better than that. He identifies with the error, right? He identifies with the error. And I can tell you, someone who does that, who identifies with the error and says, you know, and responds encouragingly, I can tell you that that's the team captain, whether he's the team captain in on paper or not, he's the natural leader in that team, because authority flows to those who take responsibility. Authority runs away from those who make excuses. So, authority flows to those who take responsibility. This is the kind of authority that a righteous king has. He does not set himself up as a boss so that he can blame others. Rather, he sets himself in a position where he can take responsibility for what's happening, for good and for bad. If someone comes and he's the headmaster, and someone comes bubbling into the school, this is the most fantastic school I've ever seen in my life, and I don't know how you do it, and this is wonderful, and this is great, and what do you do? You know, this is amazing. He should say thank you. He should say thank you. God's been very kind to us. Thank you. And if someone says, your kids are doing this and this and this, and I can't believe you call yourself a Christian school, and I've been, you know, he takes responsibility. He says, let me seek your forgiveness. Let me get some names. Can I pursue this for you? What can I do? How can I take responsibility for good and bad? In this way, authority flows to him. When men seek to find someone else to blame when something goes wrong, authority runs away from them. Scapegoating is the way to empty yourself of all true moral authority. You might still be the superintendent after the fiasco. You might still be the headmaster after the fiasco, or the board chairman after the fiasco. But if you spent a bunch of time blaming someone else and scapegoating someone else, then all the moral authority that you may have had before that time is vanishing. Another way of saying this is that true authority doesn't boss. True authority is obedient. True authority is obedient. When you see someone with true biblical Narnian authority, you are thinking of an obedient person. And the more obedient someone is to those who are in lawful authority over him, the more that someone grows in his own authority. Let me say that again. The more someone is obedient to the lawful authority above him and exhibits that obedience, the more he's generating a desire among those who are under his authority to be obedient to him. If an administrator is constantly complaining to his staff about the board, he is teaching them to constantly complain to their students about him. Right? That's what he's doing. That's what he's modeling. He said, the person in authority over me, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to complain and moan and whine about what the board does, and the board sinned against me, and the board didn't do this, and they didn't pass the budget, and you didn't get a raise. And now, this is one of those consistent things that Jesus teaches, one of the principles that Jesus teaches that is really profound when you think about it, but we hardly ever do. Do as you would be done by. What's the golden rule? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So, do unto the board as you would have the staff do unto you. Talk about the board the way you would have the staff talk about you. Or, if you're a teacher, talk about the administration the way you would have your students talk about you at the dinner table tonight. Because that's what's going to happen. Right? We think that we're modeling one thing for the students to imitate, and we're modeling something else completely. And so what you want to do is say, okay, in the Lord's Prayer, the Lord told us to put in there, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. This is a fundamental biblical orientation. The judgment in Matthew 7, the judgment with which you judge, you shall be judged. The measuring rod you hold up to others will be held up to you, right? The judgment with which you judge, you shall be judged. So when Jesus says, judge not lest you be judged, he's not saying don't make judgments of others. He's saying don't judge with a double standard. Don't have a high, high view of authority for those who are under you and a very low view of authority for those who are above you. If you do that, you're going to be demanding the people beneath you to submit to you because they're not going to want to do it. But if you're living out true sacrificial obedience, and you are rendering that to the lawful authorities above you, then the people under your authority are going to be doing the same thing to you because you're going to be modeling that. And you might say, but you don't understand. The school board that I work for, the school board members are Satan and Beelzebub and you know, Darth Vader, you know, all these. It's a wicked, wicked school board. I have to be disrespectful for, you know. No, that's a simple one too. If they're that way, what are you working for them for? If they're like that, what are you doing there? And if they're not like that, then honor them. Right? If you can see your way clear in your conscience to work for them and take their money, then you do what the Bible says, which you honor, 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 honor. And you back them up. And you back them up when they do some boneheaded thing. Right? The board calls you in and says, do you think we should do policy X or policy Y? And you say, oh, by no means should you do policy X. You ought to do policy Y. And here are the reasons why you should do this. And you give your reasons for policy Y. But they hear from some other teachers and parents and so forth, and they decide to go with the wrong policy. They adopt the stupid policy, not the wise policy. Now what do you do? Provided that it wasn't a decision to start carrying textbooks marketed, you know, published by Satan and Sons, the satanic Christian bookstore, Christian textbook thing. If they're not doing that, if they're not denying the faith, if it's not something like that, and you can submit to it, what you do is you submit to it. And you go back and talk to your students, and they said, policy X! Ah! Right? I can't believe they went with policy X. Everybody sees that it's policy Y, and the students say, for the following reasons. And they give all the reasons that you just gave to the board the previous day. And you say, no, but what you have to understand is that we decided to go this way because... Right? And you stand with the board. You submit to the board. You represent the board. Provided it's not a breach of the Ten Commandments. You're not disobeying God. And, you know, no human authority is absolute. As we're going to see, as Trumkin teaches us, no human authority is absolute. And that in schools, that includes administrative authority or teacher's authority or civil authority. No human authority is absolute. But it's genuine. And submission only matters when you don't want to do it. Okay, that's the only time submission bites. That's the only time is when you don't want to do it. If your husband came home and said, you know, put on your red dress, baby, let's go out to dinner and dinner and dancing and let's have a great time, you wouldn't say, I submit. You would say, great, you have agreement. There's no need to submit because you already have a meeting of the minds. It's when you disagree. Right, that you've got the problem. So it's the same sort of thing with that you have with forgiveness. You can only forgive someone when they really did something wrong to you. We want to forgive people when they didn't do something wrong to us. Right? If they didn't do something wrong, then we can forgive them. Or if they did something wrong, if they in the apology they do a little weasel apology, pretending not to have done something wrong. You know, non-Christians say I had a little bit too much to drink and I said some things that I didn't mean. And the person says, okay, I can forgive you since you didn't really mean it. Right? The deep down you didn't really mean it. And then we say the same thing. Well, I'm sorry. I said some things I didn't believe. I don't mean. And please, I'm sorry. And nobody ever apologizes. You know, I said some things yesterday to hurt you. And I meant every word of it at the time. And I was trying to hurt you. And I was wrong for wanting to hurt you. Would you please forgive me? You say, I can't forgive you for that. You're admitting that you did something wrong. But in the Bible, that's the only thing you can forgive is something wrong. You don't forgive mistakes. If you bump into someone accidentally in the hall, you say, pardon me. You don't say, forgive me. If you knock them down on purpose, you say, forgive me. And if you do it 7 times in one day and say, forgive me each time, Jesus says, each time, forgive your brother. Even though, along number 3, you suspect that his repentance is not sincere, and maybe the pastor ought to have a talk with him, and maybe we can get some help to him, but Jesus says, you forgive him. So, when you, it has to do with submission is only true submission when you disagree. Just like forgiveness is only true forgiveness when there was genuine sin. My favorite example, and this is probably where I learned the center of this, my favorite example in all of Narnia is Trumkin the Dwarf. What does Trumkin think about the old Narnians calling for help with the horn? This is in Prince Caspian. He thinks that such tactics are, quote, are quote, all eggs and moonshine. It's in Prince Caspian, page 96. All eggs and moonshine. And then, when they decide to do it, and as a result, Dr. Cornelius says that they should send messengers to at least two other places in case the promised help arrives there, what does Trumpkin think about that? Well, the first result of all this foolery is not to bring us help, but to lose us two fighters. He says, should we blow the horn? No, we shouldn't blow the horn. And then they decide they're going to do it, and then they're going to send two messengers out in case the help comes in unexpected places. And Trumpkin says, look, we're losing ground fast. This is a bad idea. So this is Trumpkin's response. This is a bad idea. But then how does Trumpkin demonstrate his true loyalty? When the decision is made by Caspian, the one in authority, the one who has to make the call, Trumpkin is as committed as anyone there to faithful obedience. He doesn't try to sabotage it to prove his point. Okay? Does he want Caspian to make this decision? No. But when Caspian makes the decision and it goes contrary to what Trumpkin wants, Trumpkin could try to submarine the whole thing, right? He could just try to say, implement the decision in a half-hearted way, and then the whole thing is a disaster, and then he could say something like, see, I said it was going to be a disaster. This proves me right. But how does he prove his true loyalty? When the decision is made by Caspian, Trumpkin is as committed as anyone to see that it succeeds. And this is from Prince Caspian, page 98. But I thought you didn't believe in the horn, Trumpkin, said Caspian. No more I do. This is actually a passage you should memorize. No more I do, Your Majesty. But what's that got to do with it? I might as well die on a wild goose chase as die here. You are my king. I know the difference between giving advice and taking orders. You've had my advice, and now it's the time for orders. You're my king. I know that a king needs advice, and when you want my advice, I give it, and I give it honestly in an ungarbled way. And when the decision goes against me, I will heartily throw myself into implementing what I think is a bad move, and I'm going to do my best to make it work. Because you want my advice, I give you my advice honestly. You want my obedience, I give you my obedience honestly. And you do both. You don't murmur quietly about how this is a bad thing, and you don't refuse to give your input and then try to make it work. You don't go the opposite way, where you give all your input and then refuse to try to make it work. What you do is you do both. And this is, I don't think I have to explain to you how alien this kind of thinking is in the modern world. This is an alien thought form. And it's not an alien thought form because Narnia doesn't exist. It's an alien thought form because we're not paying attention to what Jesus taught in the Gospels. And Lewis did pay attention to how Jesus taught and how Jesus led and how Jesus would have us lead. But this is the wonderful thing. This is we see here Trumpkin's submission to authority. Right? We see submission to authority. But this does not turn Trumpkin into a blind cult member or a brainless foot soldier in some dictator's army. His loyalty has set and very defined limits. And this is very important. His loyalty is defined by something higher than the king. There were some psychologists, they're clinical psychologists some time ago who did an experiment, and clinical psychologists are constantly doing this sort of thing, and it makes them happy, I suppose. They had a theory that conservative authoritarian Christians would be more conducive, they would be more open to being given commands that were wrong, sinful, than other people. And so what they did is they brought a bunch of random people in, and they had a little pseudo-scientific setup where they had knobs that were supposed to deliver electrical charges to people, and it was an experiment on how much electricity people could tolerate, what the pain levels were, and then they could see the person who was in the chair strapped down in the other room, who was an actor. There was nothing wired up to anything. And that reminds me of another story that I'll tell you in a minute. But And so what they do is they bring people in off the street, and they would find out if what, you know, were they conservative Christian, authoritative, you know, conservative, believe that you ought to obey authority and so forth. And they would tell them, we need some help on this experiment, and could you turn this up to 6 and turn it up to 7 and turn it up to 8. And the farther they would turn it up, they were told that the person in the chair had volunteered for it and was cooperative, signed all the releases and everything. But the farther up they went, the more the person started screaming and flipping out, stop it, for God's sake, stop it, I'm dying, you know, that sort of thing. And they were going to show scientifically that people who had been browbeaten into an authoritarian frame of mind were going to just slavishly turn it up with the guy in the white lab coat there was telling them to turn it up. And what they found was exactly the opposite. Right? The people who had firm belief in God's law, firm belief in authority, rebelled against them very early on. And the people who were relativistic and didn't have a strong view of authority at all, they just buried the needle. Well, why is that? Well, it should be very simple to explain when you think about it. If you know that if you have a high view of the authority of your father and mother or your supervisor or your branch manager or your the captain of the ship or whoever it is over you, if you have a strong view of authority like that because you learned it from the Bible, you know that there's an authority beyond him. There's an authority. You know that when you get to this branch manager, you get to the employer, you get to the superintendent, you know that the chain of command is not exhausted at that point. Or you know that there are higher ups that have input on this as well, right? There is something you are not crippled, you're not handcuffed, you're not bound up into some sort of cult-like mind control simply because you think that obedience and submission is a duty in all the normal give and take of life. It is a duty in all the normal give and take of life. You ought to obey, submit cheerfully, implement cheerfully, confess your bad attitude, don't moan and whine, and just do it. But you say, I need to reserve to myself the right to complain, because what happens if the superintendent stops telling me to do things that I don't like and starts telling me to do things that are immoral? Right? I want to be prepared. I want all my moaning and complaining to prepare me for the day when I will be a stalwart, obedient Christian. So I'm going to prepare for being an obedient Christian then by being a disobedient Christian now. But it doesn't work that way. You prepare yourself to be an obedient Christian then by being an obedient Christian now. If someone gives you commands, if a lawful authority gives you commands that are simply inconvenient for you, then you obey them cheerfully from the heart. And that obedience is going to be the best preparation for drawing the line saying, I refuse to go any further. This other story that I reminded myself of doesn't really have anything to do with my talk, but it's too good of a story to pass up. It reminded me of hooking things up to things that are not really hooked up. I recently heard a gentleman speak at Disputatio at New St. Andrews College. He was a successful attorney, and he was describing how idealistically he had graduated from law school. He was in the Air Force. And he came out of law school, a freshly minted attorney, going to fight for truth and justice. Now everything was simple and clear and black and white. And he went over to Germany, and he said his very first case out of law school was a young airman who had stolen some video equipment from the base store. And the military police had hauled him in and questioned him, interrogated him for hours, and finally got a confession out of him. But the way they got the confession out of him is this guy was not too smart, and they ran wires from him over to a Xerox machine. And they told him it was a lie detector. And they said, did you steal the stuff? And he said, no, I didn't. And they pushed the button, and this little sheet came out and said, you are lying. No, I didn't do it. Push the button. Well, let's run the test again. And push the button, and kept coming out, and you were lying. Well, he finally confessed, yeah, I took it. And so that was the end of my friend's law school idealism, I suppose. You can tie that into the topic of the talk however you want. Sometimes I just remind myself of things. So, Trumpkin exhibits his true loyalty to God, to Aslan, even though he doesn't believe in Aslan. So, here's, because it's very interesting in the story what happens. Trumpkin's loyalty, he's willing to go die for a bad idea. Right? He's willing to go die for an idea he disagrees with. He's willing to die for a bonehead strategy in his book. But someone suggests, what are some suggested allies for the old Narnians in this story? Someone says, well, there's an ogre or two and a hag that we could introduce you to up there. Prince Caspian, page 76. And what does Trumpkin think about that? Why don't we get the ogres and the hags and the creepy creatures to come join us? Trumpkin says, what does Trumpkin respond with? When someone observes that they would forfeit Aslan's favor if they were to take such allies, Trumpkin shows us exactly how we should react with such compromises. Oh, Aslan, said Trumpkin cheerily, but contemptuously, what matters much more is you wouldn't have me. Right, you bring the hags and the ogres in, and I'm gone. Right, I'll go die for a bad idea, but I won't die to advance a wicked idea. Right, so he has a set, defined line. Right? He won't compromise basic moral principles. At the same time, not inconveniencing yourself is not a basic moral principle. For many people, it functions as though it were a basic moral principle, but it's not a basic moral principle. What matters is you wouldn't have me. And so you say, you know, if the school board or if the administration or if the school starts doing dishonest things, wicked things, wrong things, it's just fundamentally messed up, you can say, you know, I can submissively go. But this is how you want to think of it. Whenever, because we live in a fallen world, there will be schools that you have to walk away from, or job opportunities you have to not take, or, you know, there are many times where you have to say, I'm sorry, I just can't do that. This is not a perfect world. It's not a Pollyanna world. You've got to make those hard choices. The best way to prepare for that is to cheerfully and industriously obey every lawful command that you can cheerfully obey. Right, that's the best preparation. I oftentimes tell engaged couples with regard to sexual temptation, I said it's like a football game, and the ends switch at half. And, you know, the direction you're going switches at halftime. So while you're engaged, the devil wants you together and God wants you apart. After halftime, after the ceremony, God wants you together and the devil wants you apart. Okay? We switch. All right, so the devil wants you together now, sexually. God wants you apart. When you're married, God wants you together and the devil wants you apart. Now, anything when you let the devil rack up points on the scoreboard now, after the half, he still has those points. Right? It's much easier for him to drive you apart after you're married if you're accustomed to doing what he says. Right? If you fall into these temptations, you're going to fall into those temptations which are going the other direction after you're married. Right? And if you honor God now, sexual self-control, abstinence, purity, that is going to help you develop and cultivate a godly sexual life while you're married. Right? So the fact that things switch ought not to throw you. Right? The fact that the direction switches. It's a similar sort of thing here. If you say, you know, if I allow myself to be put upon, you know, sometimes I feel like a doormat, or sometimes I feel like I'm just submissively putting up with a bunch of rinky-dink, petty stuff that I shouldn't be putting up with. Well, you need to understand that when you put up with those sorts of things, when you put up with those sorts of offenses, those sorts of rudenesses, those sorts of thoughtless decisions, when you graciously, cheerfully put up with it, accept it from the hand of God, from the heart, and thank God for it, which is different than being bitter and resentful, right? You just thank God for it. You need to understand that when the time comes where there a line must be drawn and you must say something, you must say, no, we can't do that to the parents because we promised them that we wouldn't. You know, let's take a scenario. We can't do that. We gave our word that we wouldn't do that. Right? And someone has to say something. You are going to be much better equipped to say something when something has to be said, if you have been accepting from the Lord that which, you know, quietly and cheerfully, where nothing had to be said. And the person who moans and complains and whines about all the little rinky-dink things, when it comes to the great crisis, he's useless. The great showdown, he capitulates. Trumpkin is the kind of person you want. And this, at this point in the story, he doesn't know Aslan, doesn't believe in Aslan. He comes to believe in him later. But here's the principle. He says, I'm under authority and I'm going to cheerfully do those things that I disagree with. And when you have to say something, your voice is, the fact that you're the one speaking is going to be powerful. Right? Because you're saying, what? I thought you were just a mindless drone. No. Cheerful Christians are not mindless drones. Cheerful Christians are not mindless drones. And that would become obvious to anybody who knows you at all. So here's true independence of mind. In other words, Trumpkin knows that he's under authority when it comes to practical decision making. Caspian is the king, and he must decide when, where, and how they will fight the enemy. Someone has to decide those things. And Trumpkin will give his advice, but he knows that the decision is not his to make. But if it goes beyond strategy and tactics and becomes a matter of whether they should join up with wicked ogres and hags, that would be a decision that's not Caspian's to make. Okay, Caspian doesn't have the authority to join up with hags and ogres. And if he tried it, Trumpkin would head on down the road. Trumpkin knows that authority is genuine, it requires obedience, and that it is also limited, requiring limits to the obedience. Authority and submission is genuine, and we must cheerfully and exuberantly embrace it in its appointed domain, and it's limited and bounded, and we must not step one foot outside that appointed domain. That goes back to the talk on Kuiper this morning. We have the doctrine of sphere sovereignty, where in different authorities in different places have bounds, set bounds to their authority. Now, this is the... let me tie all of this in conclusion in with child rearing, bringing up your own children in your own home, and child training and education in the school as parents are using you as educators to supplement and reinforce what they are doing. The right kind of obedience in the right kind of student gets you tough-minded independence at the other end. If you want, if you're just pounding the kids and you're just saying, conform, 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 you're just going to get conformists coming out the other end. If it's pandemonium and you don't require them to conform to anything, you're going to get anarchists coming out the other end. What you want to do is instill the right view of authority at the right time. Okay, the right view of authority at the right time so that when the child is growing up into maturity, they're starting to fill the shoes that you've established for them. I'm going to illustrate this with a parental parent-child example, but the same sort of thing, I think, applies to schools, and you can make the necessary application to schools. When kids are little and cute, sin is cute. Right? Sometimes you have trouble disciplining them because it's so cute. And so the kids are doing their thing, and they're just little half pints, and their sin is cute. And so some parents indulge. They indulge it, and they indulge it, and they indulge it, and the kid gets older and older. And the older the kid gets, the less endearing the sin gets. But it's also getting too big to manage because you've got years of subsidizing it. You've already set the pattern. You've sort of lost control of the situation. And then the kids grow, and so there's minimal controls as the kids are little, and the sin doesn't really do that much damage. And as the kids get older, they get to junior high age and then high school age, where sin can genuinely wreck a life. Sin can take a life. You're screwing around in the car, you kill somebody. Okay? You're old enough to buy drugs. You're old enough to molest a little kid that you're babysitting. You're old enough to really mess up. You get someone pregnant, serious problems. It's not cute anymore. It's not funny. It's not endearing. It's not cute. And many times, teachers and parents get to 13, 14, 15, and they panic. Okay, and what do you do when you panic? You make rules. You clamp down rules. And so you have minimal governance when the kids are little, and you start maximizing the rules and the restrictions the older the kids get. Which is backwards, because when the kids are growing up, they're headed toward 18, right, when they're off to college, or they're going to join the Navy, which is not a bastion of righteousness, right? So they're going to go off, and they're going to be out of your control when they're 18. How are they going to think of these rules and restrictions and groundings and just law? Paul tells us that law provokes sin. Right? It's like law is like jabbing at an angry bear with a stick through the bars of the cage. That's what law does. And law received the wrong way. What you really need to do, and it should be backwards from this. When our kids were little, they lived in a totalitarian police state. We had all sorts of authority, all sorts of restrictions. You know, we governed, we disciplined for attitude. We wanted them to be cheerful. We wanted them to obey all the way, promptly. Something I learned from my father, delayed obedience is disobedience. Right? Reinterpreted obedience is disobedience. So we had a very tight system when our kids were little. And we wanted the same sort of thing at Logos, where the kids had defined boundaries and rules, and everything was laid out in big block letters. We want you to know exactly what we expect from you, and if you put one toe across that line, you're going to get it. Okay? Because we want you to learn the meaning of authority. But this is not because we were control freaks in our family or in the school. It's because we wanted them to learn authority and the right kind of authority and the right response to authority when the stakes were still low. And then the older the kids get, you lift restrictions. You take the rules away. You just lift them. You take them away. I remember having a talk with my daughter, my oldest daughter, Becca, when she turned 16. I said, Becca, I want you to understand that we brought you up a certain way. We've been very strict on all sorts of things, movies, videos, things you listen and watch. And I want you to know you're 16, we trust you, and you can do anything you want. You don't have to check, you know, you don't have to check with me. If your friends want to go to a movie, you can just go to the movie. So we took the restrictions away. Why were we willing to do something as harebrained as that? Because we knew that she had already internalized the standards. She was already embracing and loving the standards. You take the rules away. The rules are training wheels. They're not. It's not the way you're supposed to go through life. And tragically, sadly, many Christian colleges, many other institutions, they feel that the only way you can keep moral disorder from breaking out is by just putting another layer of rules on. What you really ought to be, what you're after is self-governance. What you want is independence of mind, which is not gratifying itself. What you want is submission to authority that understands the true nature of submission, what you should be submitting to and what's not an issue. And in the meantime, Becca was talking to some of her friends at school, other girls in Christian homes, and they were talking, there was some nasty movie, I forget what it was, something that was unedifying to the nth degree, right? Nobody in their right mind would go see it. And these girls really wanted to see it, but oh, I can't see it. My parents would kill me if they found out that I went to see it. These girls, friends of Becca's, wanted to see this movie. But they knew their parents, because their parents had started slapping rules on them. And Becca said, well, my dad said I could go. And they said, what, Becca? What? And she said, but I don't want to. Right? That's what you want, right? You want it internalized. You're not trying to just corner the kids. You're trying to educate and teach them so they understand what you're talking about. And you've basically got a deadline of when they leave the home and when they leave your community, the deadline for them to have this internal gyroscope, knowing what you're talking about, is that time when they leave. It might be in some families when the child's 18. It might be in other families when the child's 22, depending on when they're going to school and who's subsidizing and who's paying for it. But basically, somewhere between 18 and 22, they're out. And you ought not to be trying to govern them with parental authority after that point, when your daughter's married, you're not her head anymore. And when your son has left and has established his own family, you're not in charge. You're not in charge anymore. You got your shot earlier. That's part of what your child rearing is all about. That's what your educational system, that's what the school is all about, is you want to have these values, this worldview, this system of thinking to be internalized, and you want your kids to hold it, embrace it, and love it. And if you have been modeling the kind of authority, if you've been exercising the kind of authority over them, which is itself submissive to God, it's going to be true authority and not like the scribes, which means that they're going to listen to you. They're going to care what you think. You're not going to have to demand respect because God's just going to pour it out over your head. God's going to give you moral authority because you're submitting to Him. But if you want to not submit to Him, but have them submit to you the way you're refusing to submit on up the line, you're wanting something that God in this world has determined not to give. He doesn't do that. He doesn't work that way. What He wants to do is teach them through you. Your example sets an example for them. Well, let's thank God together. Father, thank you for our time together here now. I pray that you'd be with us as we meditate on these things. We commit it all to you, and we commit the evening to you as well. In Jesus' name, amen.